Very solid. Now we have Santenna's Franklin Mason and Eastern Catholic Practice by Dr. Matthew Steenberg, who is Director of Theology.
Right?
Yes, yeah. Okay, and great friend. Back again to regale us with his wonderful presentation and his very good PowerPoint. Or old and present on a PowerPoint works.
Yeah.
So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Like having a new toy when you first get it, you have to play with it quite a lot, and then of course you lose interest quickly, and I shall go back to having completely unillustrated talks soon. I must apologise for those of you who are wondering why I'm dressed in lay clothes today, never having been so before. It's because I left my cassock on the other side of town and I have not got the energy at present to go and get it, so forgive me. Beauty will save the world. Some of you, I hope, know this quotation. This is from the great, if not, and I think probably, yes, the greatest of all Christian novelists, Fyodor Dostoevsky. Now, when he wrote this phrase, he was not talking about icons or images or art of any kind. He was talking about the aesthetic of the divine. Beauty and God are in some sense equatable from Dostoevsky. God is fundamentally beautiful, and it is an encounter with God's beauty that is salvific. But even though he's not talking about icons or about images, what he says is applicable to the theology of the icon as I'd like to look at it today. And I'll come back to what exactly my approach will be in a moment. But first, a little summary of how we've got to this point in sixth week of term. I hope I'm not the only one who's mortified that it's already sixth week. I feel as if term has just begun and I'm already filling out tutorial reports on my students. We've had two sessions now, one by myself and one by Dr. Valpy, both giving fairly broad background perspectives on the theology of the image in these two very distinct and in some ways very dramatically different traditions of religious belief and practice. What struck me in the last session a fortnight ago, listening to Ken speak, was the idea of act and action toward the image. He spoke of attending to the image, attending to the motive. And I wanted to chase up this notion of what we do with icons and images in the Eastern Christian tradition. Now, I touched a little bit on this in my own first talk from a theological point of view, the idea of what can be done with an image, what should be done, what might you say cannot be done. And I would like not to trace over the same territory again today. What I'd rather look at is the practical individual notions of what one does. How is an icon incorporated into the actual religious life of the individual person and into the larger corpus of the Christian faithful? So I've called this talk Icon and Act, and then I've given it what I realize now, having looked at it on the big screen for the first time, is a rather complicated subtitle, Transcendence and Transformation in Eastern Iconic Praxis. How horrid. I started by saying Eastern Iconographic Praxis, and then remembered that that's just bad grammar. Praxis here being a nice Greek word for practice, but it actually incorporates something a little bit more than just practice. Praxis is the whole demeanor towards something, attitude towards and involvement with a thing. It encompasses not only what we do, but what we think and how what we do affects us. So it is not just a nice Greek replacement for an English word, which I have to say scholars sometimes like to do for reasons that defile description, put Greek words where an English will do. But I don't know of an English word that nicely sums up everything tied into praxis. As I said in my first talk, I was looking broadly theologically at the icons, doctrinally, incarnationally, notions of transcendence and divinity, etc. I would like to look much more personally now and ascetically at the icon. What is the function of an icon within the ascesis of the Christian person? Now, ascesis, for those of you who don't know this term, or ascetic, asceticism is, I believe I may have mentioned it in my first talk, but I'll redefine it here in any case, is an old Greek sporting term, ascesis, and it simply means preparation. And it was what you used to do to prepare yourself for combat, i.e. stretches and warming up and practices, and, well, in the ancient Greek world, it meant coating yourself with oil. That is not normally figured into Christian ascesis so much, though we do still coat babies in oil before we dunk them in the water, though I don't think for the same reasons. But the basic meaning of ascesis is simply preparation. This has been carried over into Christian terminology in the idea of preparation for redemption, preparation for eternity. So ascesis is taken to be that which involves the person actively in the transfiguration of salvation. Things which one does. Now, I always get a bit nervous how to define ascesis in a Western context, because the easiest way to define it would be the things you do to influence your salvation, which of course in a Protestant-influenced milieu causes red flags to start flying up everywhere. You don't do things to be saved. Okay, fine. It's not meant in that way. But it is meant from the perspective of a holistic understanding of the human person as engaged with salvation. Salvation is always something done by God, but a human person is involved. As someone once rather pithily put it, God will save you, but he will never force you to be saved. You have to respond. So ascesis might be understood as that response, but that response is always an act of will, and it's also understood as an act of aggression. There's this lovely passage in the Gospel where Christ says, and this doesn't get quoted a lot in many circles, the kingdom of heaven belongs to, does anyone know how it ends? No? Well, I mean, that's nice. Yes, he does say things to that effect. That's not what I'm looking for. No, he also says that. We're going to go on for a long time like this, aren't we? I'll just tell you. Kingdom of heaven belongs to those who take it by force, he says.
Only once. That is only said once.
Sorry?
That is only said once.
Yes, it is. And following my normal pattern of exegesis, when Christ says something once, it's because it's really important. he also speaks of the doing violence to attain the kingdom of heaven. Mott has asked, where is that? And the answer is, I don't know, a good concordance will tell you. My students either love or hate the fact that I never memorize Bible verses as a matter of principle. But we can go to that later. The idea of ascesis as a battle. There is a real spiritual defect to the human person. We are broken. This is a basic confession of Eastern Christianity. How you want to understand the Advent event, brokenness, original sin, or whatnot is a different question. But however you understand it, there is something deeply wrong with the human condition. And the depth of that disfiguration is such that attempts towards holiness must be waged against that own brokenness within us. In other words, we do battle with ourselves because we are not used to living a holy life. It should be natural to us, but it feels like something foreign. And so there must be a kind of combat waged. Not always violent in the sense that we understand it, but violent in the sense that one must attend to it and work on it, and it's not always easy. I'll come back to that as we go along. So, I would like to spend my time today, and I promised, though I'm off to a bad start, to try and be briefer than I was in my first talk, where I took 45 minutes to mean roughly 75. I'd like to go through a few things. I'd like to recapitulate very briefly the theological idea of veneration as a starting point that I touched on last time. I'd like to look then at the ancient praxis of icons, how they were used in some of our very earliest examples. And then I'll look at modern praxis, how icons are used in modern liturgical life and personal life. And then I look at the production of icons, how they're actually made, because that's tied into their ascetical function. How an icon is formed and painted is intimately linked into what one is supposed to do with it and what it's supposed to do for one. And that will lead me into some of the canons of iconography, which I promised I would talk about. And I brought a big book to help me when I get there. So we'll carry on. Firstly, to recapitulate the idea of veneration, the theological notion of what you do with an icon. As we spoke of, I guess, 4 weeks ago now, the idea here is veneration is to pay homage through a thing to a thing. To pay homage through a painted representation to the prototype depicted therein. And we saw that the key significance of this was the incarnational theology of the Christian confession. This was what was tied down so strongly at the Seventh Ecumenical Council in 787. To deny the possibility of venerating an icon of wooden paint is to deny the physical material incarnation of Christ. Therefore, in confession of that incarnation, one venerates these images as means of passing love to the prototype. But the image and the veneration shown to it also does something for us. Oopsie, skip that. So the first evidence of this comes in the catacombs, which vary in date. The Roman catacombs vary in date from sort of the end, very, very end of the 2nd century up until about the 6th or the 7th. The most remarkable structures, if you ever go to Rome and don't visit the catacombs, you should feel great shame for the rest of your life, or at least until you go back. And there are tremendous numbers of them. There's not just one catacomb complex, there are a great many. And as I mentioned before, it's here that we find some of our earliest examples of Christian religious art. Here are a few. The Good Shepherd on the upper left-hand side. It's not labelled Christ, but it's clearly meant to be Christ, and there are icons of much later periods that have, without the sheep on the side, the same figure, a man with a lamb on his shoulder. Harking back to the Gospel passage, I am the Good Shepherd, when there were 99 sheep, but one is lost, I go out and find one who's lost. Here is a much more explicitly Gospel scene painted on the same walls. The woman with an issue of blood who touches the hem of Christ's garment, he turns to her and says, "Your faith has healed you." Now you'll see these are dating here from the 3rd century, so the very, very early paintings, but you'll see as we go on that they bear similarities of style already to the icons that will be produced 1600 years later. Now, it appears that the early usage of icons was largely memorial, i.e. it was a carryover to some degree from Greco-Roman memorial and funerary practices. In Rome, when someone died, over their face was normally put a board or a sheet on which was painted their own face as a kind of memorial. And there were several examples of this extant. And it appears that Christians started to do the same thing. It's very telling that the first examples of art come in tombs, in large graveyards. But it's also interesting that there's a shift in what is being portrayed. We don't, for example, to the best of my knowledge, have any examples from the earliest period of paintings of the deceased. We, for example, do not have a painting of the person buried in this crypt. What you do have is a crypt with a cross on it and something like Christ the Good Shepherd, who is clearly not meant to be understood as buried there. Or on the walls of a room with several crypts, Christ the Healer. Your faith has made you well. This is a slightly later catacomb, the mid-4th century. And again you see the kind of images being selected. Samson and the Lion, which may also be a reference to people like St. Polycarp, who is martyred for the faith by being devoured by lions. It may serve a double purpose. You have the scene of Christ raising his friend Lazarus from the tomb. Again, keep in mind here the shape of the buildings, etc., for when we come back to this later. What's significant here is that this is not funerary art. These are not lamentations. They are scenes from the larger life of the church. And this is the real transformation that we start to see occurring in the usage of art. In places of memorial, you have symbols of the larger Eucharistic community of the Christian family. Scenes from the life of Christ and his ministry. Scenes from the sacrifice of the saints. Scenes, for example, of the church at prayer. This is an icon I mentioned in my first talk, of the individual standing at prayer. This is the traditional Christian stance of prayer. It's not used very often anymore, but it is, as it was, and in many situations remains, the traditional Jewish stance of prayer. Head covered, arms upheld, palms out. We also have here the earliest known image of the Theotokos, of the Mother of God, the Virgin Mary, who in her arms, I'm afraid it's a very bad photograph, in her arms holds the Christ child. This dates from the early 200s, and therefore is our earliest extant image of the Mother of God being painted. Though I'll come back to a tradition that says there were far earlier portraits in a moment, but this is the earliest one we've actually got. But again, very telling that in a place of death, of mortification, of loss of life, we are having scenes of life and scenes of community and family and church. So there is the idea that the image is bringing to the observer, the one who stands before it, the reality of something beyond the self and beyond the present moment. As you stand in this dark, damp, underground place of sorrow, one sees images of hope and life that transcend the present reality, that bring the seer into a larger understanding of the cosmos and of reality than the present moment and situation allows, and for that reason lifts up the individual moment into something greater. So the bones of those who have been killed for the faith or who have died are raised up into images of an eternal life. And so too the person who is standing before them is brought into that larger reality. So we see already, simply by the placement and the selection of images in this very early period, a kind of sacramentalization of the image. When you encounter the image, you are drawn into something. So the image is serving a purpose beyond simple artistic beauty. There may be some art. I think this one is quite beautiful. Some of the others are basically just sketches. There's nothing terribly artistically of note about them. But that's not their main function. And this is very important in later iconographic theology. I don't want to dwell too long on the ancient material, because I covered quite a bit of that before. And indeed, we don't really have anything written about iconographic theology until the iconoclastic controversy, and I spoke quite a bit about that already. What I wanted to show you is how that model of an image leading beyond itself and drawing one into something other than one's own situation is reflected in current praxis. So I'm going to show you now a whole series of photographs of icons being used in the modern day. Now, before I do, it's important for me to make a few connecting points. Firstly, images continue to memorialize. I should not suggest that that function is abandoned in Orthodox praxis. So we do have images that memorialize specific events, and we've seen some of them already in this series. The transfiguration of Christ, the resurrection, the birth of Christ, etc., or certain historical circumstances, the restoration of the icons, as we've also seen. But the veneration of these images is tied into a twofold scheme of confession and ascesis. Confession of the God who is portrayed through his saints and through these events, and the ascetical life of the believer who comes into encounter with them. Here's a fun example of a Greek Orthodox parish in America. I love the phrase, as you walk into the temple, to written in Greek first and then in English. Wash thy sins, not just your face. Which is a nice way to remind yourself of what ascesis is really about, what fasting is really about. But notice the woman who's about to enter the temple. The narthex is a separate space, a separate room. In ancient times, unbaptized people would never be allowed anywhere other than the narthex. Only the baptized, the fully initiated, would be allowed into the nave itself, into the temple. But before entering the church proper, one venerates the icons. They're not simply there to look at, they're there for veneration. And she makes the normal signs of such veneration as she does this. She crosses herself twice, bows to the ground, kisses the icon, crosses herself a third time. She'll repeat the same thing for the next icon as well. This is, in part, a sign of love for the icon itself and for the image portrayed thereon, but it's also a personal preparation for entry into the space of the temple. Before walking into the church, one pauses and one calls into one's own sense of mind and sense of spirit the images portrayed around oneself. It's an act of entry and of preparation. This is at the end of a liturgical service. Everyone goes up to the front of the church. This is for a special feast, and venerates the icon of the feast. This is an icon from the look of him of St. Nicholas the Wonder Worker of Myra and Nicaea, i.e. Santa Claus. This is a bishop who is holding the icon. You can tell he's a bishop by the rather elaborate set of vestments he's wearing. You'll note this particular vestment around his shoulder. That's the particular vestment of a bishop. You see Bishop Nicholas wearing the same thing here. This is a deacon off to the side. Interesting, just as a purely practical note, to see that there are icons on the vestments as well. Angels on both of the bishop's shoulders. Above his head is the resurrected Christ. So it is not he who speaks, but Christ. And he wears a crown. The mitre is a circular crown. It's shaped like the old imperial crown of the Byzantine Empire. There are thorns around it to remind oneself that one is martyred for Christ and crucified with him, and that the bishop's service is ultimately a service of sacrifice. But it's interesting to see how the people, and here I've chosen a photograph with a child, come up to venerate the icon again as the culmination of their celebration of the feast of the saint. One of the most noticeable features of Orthodox worship are processions with icons. So we'll look at how one works here. This is a miracle-working icon of Anna, who is here, and the Mother of God. Interesting that they're in that position, since Anna is Mary's mother. But Mary is holding in her arms the soul of her mother. That's not meant to be the living Anna, that's meant to be the spirit of Anna, and Mary is embracing her as they rejoice together in the kingdom of God. This icon is miraculous in that it is has been observed by many people to weep. The eyes will weep. I've not seen this icon myself. This is how it sits in the church. You'll notice that it's covered in quite an elaborately sewn and hemmed garment. It's put on a very special stand. You'll see that the icon of Christ on the cross, this is another icon in the shape of a cross, is adorned with flowers as well. This is then taken up by the clergy in an immense great procession. This is a small monastery in Alaska. The clergy file in rank. These are altar servers here. And people with the funny hats and the long veils are monks. People with funny hats and no veils are not monks. Everyone gets a funny hat in the Orthodox world. It's part of our tradition. And then you have priests, which are these people with the the sort of cape-like things, and deacons have the stole on just the one shoulder. The point here is that they're all dressed up in their finest. This is liturgical finery, signs of one's office. They are processing with banners, with crosses, with candles, which are obviously ceremonial since this is the middle of the day. People stand at attention along the sides, and they bring the icon amidst great ceremony. Fans, again entirely ceremonial, are continually hovered over the icon to keep insects from landing on it. It's carried in a processional manner by multiple clergy. It's preceded by the cross of Christ and followed by the gospel book. As it passes through the people, they will often prostrate themselves down to the ground as it passes by. Sometimes, in various traditions, they will reach out to touch the priests as they pass by with the image. Interesting, if I could just go back to the previous image. Interesting to see that even the banners have icons on them. The cross has an icon of Christ painted on it. Icons are everywhere. What exactly are these people doing? It's worth noting that the icon is understood in the Orthodox Church as integrated into the practical work of living out what is called the life in Christ. Orthodox people don't normally refer to Christianity as a religion. They refer to it simply as a life. The life in Christ, as one of its most famous writers has put it. It's not a faith system, it's not a belief structure, it's a way to live and think and be bound up in the life of the incarnate God. And the place of the icon is understood as practically significant in living out this life, of seeking the transformation of broken human existence, and of transcending fallen reality and obtaining communion with the divine. The icon is not a magic key that does all of this, but it's a useful tool. So, as much as an icon is a thing, it's tied into acts. And that's what this procession is an example of. You've got the thing, the icon, but intimately interwoven with that object are the acts going along with it. So it's not just what you've got, but what do you do with it? Indeed, sort of a classic pithy litmus test for how do you know if an image is actually an icon rather than just an image? And the classic answer is, can you pray in front of it? So the question is not about its merits as a piece of art, its merits of composition, but the practical usage. Can you use it as an icon? That's the test. This is a nice litmus test, because it allows some really rather horrific icons to still be called icons. One of the most famous modern saints of the Orthodox Church is from Russia, called Saint Seraphim of Sarov, a great luminary of the Orthodox life, who prayed his whole life in front of one icon of the Mother of God, and it's just horrible. I thought about showing it to you, but it's just too bad. And I couldn't find it. So I'll try to find it if I can and show you a picture of it. But again, it's the question is not artistic caliber, but can you pray? Does it help you?
Can I stop it? You're saying that, in a way, definition and icon, but there's this whole canon of iconography. Does it have to fill both criteria, obviously? I mean, it's something that an image that one could pray in,
yes,
but doesn't follow the canon.
It does, yes, absolutely. I think sometimes the statement is used to help explain why some non-canonical images have nonetheless been used in Orthodox churches. And so it's a sort of cover-all in a way. So the real test is, can you pray? But the canons still apply, so you're not allowed to use that sort of litmus test. It's an unofficial statement, rather. It's not itself part of the official teachings of the church, of the tradition. We'll come back to those canons in a moment, and we'll see why the canons are important for precisely that sort of reason. But it's precisely for this sort of question, for this sort of reason, that Orthodox people normally would not refer to icons as art. They wouldn't call them religious art. They may be artistic in a sense, but they are really functional ascetical tools, and they're understood primarily as spiritual tools rather than objects of artistic admiration. They're of value theologically, but also practically. Now, that practical usage, this idea, do come in, there's a chair there, that practical usage is tied into many of the ritualistic elements we've already seen. The idea that before an icon one bows. Why would one do that? Any guesses? Why would one bow before an icon? No points at all if you say because you're a heretic worshipping an idol.
Icons are portals to the divine.
Yes. So you bow in a sense out of humility before the divinity that is conveyed through this image. And it's the bowing that's significant. It's the act of actually humbling oneself. The icon provides a focal center point for physical acts of ascesis. It's actually taking one's body, bowing it to the earth, that has ascetical value. One will make the sign of the cross in front of an icon because, as we covered in the first session that I led, icons are all fundamentally Christological. No matter what the image on an icon may be, whether or not the image itself has anything to do with Christ, every icon is Christological in the sense that they're all based off of the theology of the Incarnation. So the cross of Christ is always drawn on oneself before an icon. One kisses the icon again in veneration for the object thereon. One senses icons. Why would you sense an icon? Any idea? Sensing meaning to take incense in a pot on a chain and swing it at it. Any idea why we would do this?
It could be protective.
Mm-hmm. In what sense? Can you explain?
Sort of sanctified air as made to pervade the icon.
Yes. Yes, very good. It's protective in that sense. Also in an ancient sense, I think probably far more practical. Insects don't like incense. It's a natural bug repellent. So the idea of keeping things away from this sacred object, but also purifying the space. So this act of, again, engaging oneself with the idea that the holiness of God requires purity. God is always holy, but that encounter requires the sanctification of space and attitude and attention. So incense is used as a way of ritualistically calling to mind and into reality that purification. Again, it's an act, it's a ritual, but precisely one that causes this deep reality to etch itself away at one's consciousness. Interestingly, as soon as the priest has venerated the icons, he will turn around and venerate with the censer all the people. So the idea is that people themselves are icons. They are, in a sense, the ultimate icons. They're the ultimate examples of the meeting place of God and man. So part of the ritual is this mutual sanctifying the icon and then realizing that there is sanctification in the person. The priest will bow to the icon, turn around, and bow to the people. Again, the idea behind all of these acts is that the icon becomes the means whereby practices of purification, a focus of attention on the inward states necessary to have communion with God come about. When an icon is carried in procession, one follows behind it. One does not walk in front of it or beside it. The reason for this being, again, a kind of making physical of the teaching that one must learn to be obedient and to follow the will of another. Now, one clearly is not following the will of an icon, but the physical act of following behind a procession, calls that to mind in a way that is often far deeper than someone simply saying, you need to be very obedient. You need to learn how to follow. There's something about the physical act of doing it that is helpful. So the icon, in a sense, gives one the tools, both in its structure and in its usage, to find confessional elements of the faith within one's own consciousness and life. This is why production of icons is such a zealously guarded tradition. Because an icon is, again, not understood as an artistic piece, but as a pastoral tool. It is a thing which can convert people and which will be involved in their spiritual growth and life. For that reason, it's not something to be engaged in, to use one of my favorite expressions, willy-nilly. No. It is to be engaged in very carefully, very prayerfully. If indeed an icon has ascetical aims, then it's only normal that one would carefully guard how an icon is made and what it presents, so that the transformation it engenders is positive transformation, right transformation. Keeping in mind again that the word orthodoxia, orthodoxy means right belief, right worship, right glory. Orthos meaning correct, literally meaning straight, but here meaning correct. So the idea is you don't want to lead people into false transformation, false asceticism, which could happen if the icon was portraying false truths. And it's for this reason not only that the tradition of how you paint is guarded, but what you paint is guarded. Now, how you paint, first of all. I said before, and I'll expand now, that you can't just sit down and paint an icon. You have to get a blessing to do it from a bishop. And there's a quite extensive path of personal asceticism, of fasting and prayer and preparation before one is allowed to paint, and an extensive period of education. Once you've gone through all that, we'll pretend that we've all done that now. Before you actually sit down to paint, there's some guidance given. I put them in the wrong order. We'll come back to Luke. Before you start work, make the sign of the cross, pray in silence, and pardon your enemies. Interesting that that's the first step in painting an icon. Forgive your brethren and sisters. Pardon all your enemies. Stop there if you cannot do this. You have no business carrying on. When you're painting, work with care on every detail, as if you were working in front of the Lord himself. So this is not just a personal task, it's a divine task. And you should paint as if God was sitting over your shoulder watching you. During work, pray in order to strengthen yourself both physically and spiritually. Avoid, above all, useless words and keep silence. Interestingly, that it's understood in this kind of guidance that painting an icon is physically exhausting work because it's taxing to the spirit, which is linked to the body. Pray in particular to the saint whose face you are painting. Keep your mind from distractions, and the saint will be close to you. Again, this is not just me painting what comes to my mind, but ask the object of your painting to help you. When you have to choose a color, I love this one, stretch out your hand interiorly to the Lord and ask his counsel. Now, if that fails, you can also use the color schemes provided in these large manuals. But I don't mean to slight this. The point is, you are not acting for yourself. This is a divine task, and there is no aspect of it, however seemingly personal and trivial, that you should treat as either of those things. So even when selecting a color, ask God's guidance. Do not be jealous of your neighbor's work. His success is yours also. When your icon is finished, thank God that his mercy has granted you the grace to paint the holy images. You did not do this. Have your icon blessed by putting it on the altar. Be the first to pray before it, before you give it to others. So an icon, once it is painted, is placed on the altar, traditionally for 40 days. never forget the joy of spreading icons in the world, the joy of the work of icon painting, the joy of being in union with the saint whose face you are painting. So it's a task of great spiritual joy. It's a task of joy, but it's also a task of sacrifice. It's not a task of my own will or of my own self. Again, these very words cancel against that. It's not my design that I get to paint. Ask the saint to show you how to paint his face. Ask God to tell you what colours to use. So it's sacrificial. My own preferences may not be what's met out. I'll go back to the slide that I put in the wrong order. St. Luke the Evangelist is traditionally understood to be the first iconographer, writing or painting the first icon of the Mother of God with her son in the first century. Obviously, is this the same Luke who wrote what is now our third gospel account? There's no historical evidence for this, of course, but it's the common understanding of the church, and indeed most iconographers, before they will start to paint, will say a whole series of prayers to St. Luke for his blessing and for his guidance. There's some examples of icons actually being painted, but it might be nice to see how this is actually done. The first thing to note is the attire of the people painting. They're monks. Not all iconographers are monks. One of our best iconographers here in Oxford is not. But for the monastics, they view it as part of their obligation and part of their spiritual work. The person of the icon is always the last thing to be painted, because once you paint it, it can't be undone. You can't throw it away. So you don't want to paint a lovely face and then ruin the background. You do everything else first. The very last thing that's painted is the face. That's not always strictly applied, but it normally is. Because, as I mentioned a fortnight ago in the discussion session, you cannot destroy an icon once it's painted, ever.
It looks a bit like the picture on the right.
Yes, go,
picture,
please.
The icon, yes. It looks like he's painting the image first.
Yes, I don't think there will be any background. This is the face of Christ, and I think the only thing that will be put along the top is the title.
Right.
This is a large panel that would go to the right side of the royal doors. It's just the face of Christ.
Mm.
It's traditionally on a plain gold background. This is St. Elias, or usually known as Elijah, I suppose, in the West, being fed by a raven in the wilderness. A nun at work, providing good exception to the rule I have just explained. She has not yet painted the table, but she is painting the faces. That's the Last Supper, Judas reaching his hand into the bowl. A little close-up here of some of the detail work involved. Icons are painted with egg tempera on carefully prepared boards. Let me read to you a description of how an icon is actually put together. The process of preparation of a board for the painting of an icon is extremely complicated. The most suitable panels of non-resinous wood, such as alder or birch, are chosen. The panel must be dry and without knots, and it is then carefully planed. The back is fixed with two horizontal struts of some hard wood to prevent warping. The panel is then scored and a layer of gesso is applied and allowed to dry. Gesso is a mixture of glue, natural glues, and chalk. A loosely woven piece of linen is glued onto the panel and a layer of gesso applied. This is usually repeated 15 or 20 times. Once this is hardened and dried, it is sanded down to a glass-like finish. A drawing is then made with a brush as the painter lays out the compositions either from his head, if it is well known to him, or he uses the authorized versions, which I'll come to in a moment, assembled into a manual for the use of painters. The drawing is then scratched onto the ground along its principal lines with a sharp tool called a stylus. If some areas are to be covered with gold, this is done first before the painting is begun. The painting is then carried out. Egg yolk is the base, not the white, The egg white is very acidic, it's simply discarded. The yellow of the yolk is extracted from the egg and mixed with earthen pigment. When egg yolk dries, the yellow disappears, it becomes clear. And natural pigments are ground by hand, mixed in with the yolk and water, and usually some vinegar as a thinning agent. The actual painting of the mane is normally done with very, very thin paint, usually in, on a face what may come close to 70 or 80 layers of paint. It's thin like watercolour paints. Once the mane painting is done, much thicker paint is applied for the detail work of the garments, etc. But yes, the faces normally will be many, many coats of paint gradually built up, and then these layers are put on afterwards with a thicker brush. One of the best-known iconographers from Kosovo at work in his studio, I apologize, the image went sour. And to show you that it's sometimes a collaborative process, this is an icon studio at that monastery where the monastics are trained in the art of iconography. You see how the first stages are normally done on the flat because the paint is too thin. If you have it up on an easel, it will simply all run down the side. Only when things have moved along quite a bit can you put it up on an easel in that manner. Now, what exactly do you paint? We get to the strictures of the canons. In what I just read to you, it said there are pattern books. This is one of them. This is one of the most famous, the Stroganov pattern book. And it's exactly what it says it is. There's no surprises. It's every icon imaginable patterned out. So if you want an icon of... And it actually, this one goes through the calendar year, from the liturgical new year on the 1st of September, all the way through the year. The saints commemorated on each day. So this is the 12th of October, and we've got Martyrs Celsius, Ferherd, who is painted in red with a little bit of cinnamon and some blue. So it gives very explicit instructions here as to the main color schemes for each of them. This is our monastic father Euthemius, Archbishop of Novgorod. His hair should be gray. His riaza, this long garment, should be sky blue with a little bit of damask, and he should have crosses painted on the upper side. So very explicit, all the way through the year, showing exactly how they should look. So you get very little freedom of selecting it out. But there were also, as I mentioned before, color schemes. And I wanted to draw these to attention, so I've got a series of icons to cycle through for comparison's sake. First of all, when one draws icons of Christ, the divinity and the humanity, this mutual confession of the two natures of Christ, are paramount to be portrayed. Christ always looks rather somber and peaceful. He never smiles in an icon, nor does he frown, nor does he ever look terribly upset or sad, including in icons of the crucifixion. You never see Christ wailing in agony in an icon. He always looks rather somber and quiet on the cross. And again, the idea is that you're conveying the spirituality of the God who is not moved by human acts, in the sense that he is moved with compassion, but he is not himself held sway by the acts of man. Red is the iconographic color of divinity, so the interior garment of Christ is always red. This is a very strict canon, though in more modern times we often see it being applied more laxly. Here's a very modern icon that's maintained it, and this harks back to that image from the catacombs of Christ the Good Shepherd, of Pimen the Shepherd, and colors good. And again, you see, first of all, the red garment closest to him. He is firstly divine as the Eternal Son, who put on human flesh. Blue is the color of humanity in the iconographic canon. So the interior garment is red, the exterior garment is blue. So you see where even these, the layering of the garments is very significant. It is an iconographic canon that the cross must always be present in the halo of Christ. You see it here. And as I mentioned last time, the title of Christ in an icon is Yahweh, which in Greek is Ho'on, the existing one. But that's the Greek translation of the Tetragrammaton. Another iconographic canon is that the halo, this is the Western term for it, is never to be pictured above the head, as so often in Western iconography, Western art. We normally think of this sort of round thing hovering above the head. The halo is always, well, from our perspective, behind, but the idea is that it radiates without from the person. It's the person emanating the light of God. This icon has one peculiarity, which is that it has holes in Christ's hands, which is normally not permitted by the canons in any icons except the crucifixion or when Christ appears to Thomas, who is doubting, and says, "Behold the holes in my hands, and put your hand in the wound of my side." Normally, it is strictly forbidden to portray the wounds of Christ in an icon, because one is engaging with the perfected nature of Christ's being. This is a point of much canonical dispute in the Orthodox world, because many people dispute, are not the wounds part of Christ's perfection? So some would argue that this is the more canonically correct rendering. Going back to our color schemes of the canons, in a traditional Orthodox icon, if you remember the color scheme for divinity and humanity, Mary, the Mother of God, will always have blue as her undergarment, because she is first and foremost a human person, earthy, and she wears over the blue garment red, because she has been made holy by God. So you see where even the color schemes become deeply instructive to the actual theology being taught, and again to the ascetical impulse of the person. I am one who attempts to clothe myself in righteousness. I'm afraid this is a very bad image of a very famous icon, the Vladimirskaya icon of the Mother of God, but again you see the same thing, blue surrounded by red, first human, then made holy and divine. And Christ is here wearing a gold garment, another colour for divinity. The canons also state that when portraying the Mother of God, she must have three stars, one on each shoulder and one on her forehead. This is variously interpreted in the Church as being she has given birth to one of the Holy Trinity, the second person of the Holy Trinity, which is made all the more potent in an image like this, where one of the stars is superimposed by the sun himself. Now that you know this neat canon of iconography by color schemes, you can tell an Orthodox icon of the Mother of God from a Roman Catholic icon of the Mother of God, following the declaration of the Immaculate Conception. Here's an example. What's the singular thing of note? What colour is Mary's undergarment? Don't look at her bonnet, but look at her undergarment. Red. And her outer garment is the darker blue. Divine first. This is a post-Immaculate Conception icon of the Mother of God, painted in the Roman Catholic Church. It's technically known as the Mother of God of the Passion. She's holding Christ, but Christ is looking over his shoulder at angels bearing the cross and the spear, the signs of his coming passion. This is, I have to say, a very popular icon in the Orthodox Church as well, but it is very definitively Roman Catholic in origin. Interestingly, Christ's garments are also inverted, which I don't entirely understand, but we won't get into that. Let's go back for a moment to any of these. One of the most insistent icons about, or canons about the Mother of God, is her relationship to Christ. It is absolutely forbidden to paint the Mother of God alone. She must always have Christ with her. So in all the icons we've seen, Mother of God, Christ, saint, etc., etc., you'll see her at the cross, with Christ hanging on the cross, you'll see her in various poses. But not here, of course. But in a sense, you do see Christ here, because this is an icon of the Annunciation. So this is understood to be the moment when she conceives the Archangel Gabriel appearing to her. I've chosen this because it actually also demonstrates another number of canons. The first is that the perspective, and we touched on this last time, is normally to be inverted, and realism is to be symbolized rather than shown. So to show that you're inside, you normally have a few tall pillars of buildings and a cloth draped between them. That's significant to show you that you're indoors, so this is meant to be in a room in her house. The Mother of God, again, in her traditional blue undergarment, red outer garment, whenever she is shown in this position in her life, she must always be carrying a spool of red thread. Do you know why? Any guesses? Ah, it's one of my favorite little canons. It's to teach you what she was doing before the angel came. Mary was given into the temple as a very young child, and according to the traditions maintained in the Orthodox Church, she was a seamstress there, and she sewed. And according to a very old document dating from the first century, they were sewing the veil of the temple, and she drew the color crimson, and she wove in the crimson thread, this being very temple, the very veil that 30 or so years later was torn in two when Christ died. So his mother actually sewed the veil that his sacrifice tore in half. And of course, her having the red thread is significant because it's the red thread of sacrifice. Another version of the same, we see all the same characteristics of the canons carried out. I also chose these last two icons in some sense as a response to the big bird that we saw in one of the images 2 weeks ago that we thought might have been a fighter jet at first, but we're told was not. And I asked about it, and Ken spoke of the idea of the celestials coming to watch. There are quite a number of icons in the Orthodox tradition that have angels watching, God watching from above. Here you've got the Holy Spirit descending from above, the three stars of the Trinity that we often see on Mary's shoulders are present in heaven. An angel comes to encounter. This is not an uncommon thing. And again, we see the inverted perspective. Rather than a vanishing point off in the distance, as I mentioned last time, the vanishing point is right about here. It's in front of the icon, not behind it, drawing you into it. So normal perspective is quite, not accidentally, but quite scientifically inverted. All of these lines are drawn so that you complete the icon. When I stand in front of this image, then the icon is complete and whole. I could go on and on about these various canons. I'm happy to answer questions about them later. But the point with all of them is one and the same. One is drawn in by the specific details of an image to a prayerful contemplation of realities that thereby affect the living out of one's life. When I learn, for example, that the Mother of God, for all of her exalted position, was fundamentally blue rather than red, i.e. fundamentally human, who was clothed in sanctity, I am taught that by a life of humility and obedience, the kind of obedience symbolized in the canonical regulation that Mary's head always be inclined. She never has her head straight up, for example. Her head is always inclined in obedience and humility to the will of God. That if I can emulate that posture myself, I can be transformed and myself made holy. The very perspective that's mandated by the canons of being drawn into the icon is one that tells me as a Christian worshipper that the story of God's life and his functioning in the world is not complete until it involves me. I am integral to this story, which is a sign of encouragement and of injunction to act. Now is the time for me to get involved in what's going on this plank and on this page. The canons, the very strictures of these painting sort of these works of what we might call art is fundamentally ascetical. The canons are there to ensure that I am able to be transformed by what I behold, and therefore the Christian's task is to respond to the image, to act. One beholds an icon, and if one simply looks at it, it's not an icon. It hasn't fulfilled its duty, at least for that individual person. An icon becomes iconic when it draws one into attendance, into action, into purification, and ultimately into the sanctification that the icon itself represents. So, I'll stop there for now. I've gone over my time already again, but I think we still have plenty of time left for discussion. So.
Maybe I can start off, kick things off with a thought that maybe you've implied by your last comment, and that is that considering what constitutes a real icon, one place that an icon would not belong would be a museum. And a similar thing could be said about Hindu Vaishnava, we're talking about mainly in our session, images.
Yes.
In a sense, they don't belong in museums. Of course, you can go to the Ashmolean and you can see Hindu Murtis, images behind glass. Whenever I look at them, I think something very essential is missing here.
Yes.
And perhaps you would say the same thing. So, this seems to suggest, and you explained in the previous talk about the temple, the nature of the temple as the place, and you're explaining now how one has to prepare oneself in order to enter that space. So, I think there's a point of commonality here that we can talk about. And you said you want to emphasize experience this time, and you're saying that this experience is one which compels to act. So I think something of that theme will also come up in the end.
Oh, good.
We'll be showing some, you know, several times I'm thinking, yes, Hindu people would say, yes, well, that's what we're also doing.
Yes, I mean, I wholeheartedly agree with those comments. It always grates on me quite strongly to go to. You can also go to the Ashmolean and see a few Orthodox icons behind quite thick glass under a stairwell. I don't like where the icons are kept at all. But yes, in a sense, a devout Orthodox person would lament that sight because you are taking something that's meant for use and simply hanging it on a wall. For the same reason, actually, in a normal Orthodox home, icons will never just be hung around the house on walls. They will be collected in one place to be used for prayer. When I was first studying iconography with a very great iconographer, who no longer lives in this country, she was insistent that an icon should never be hung up on a wall, except in an icon corner. And she loathed this tendency of some Orthodox people to sort of put icons all about every room in their house as kind of art. And she said, well, on one hand, perhaps that's a good sentiment that you want to be surrounded by these images, but an icon is a thing to be used, not just to be hung up and sort of enshrined as an artistic piece. So, yes, I entirely agree, and I do think this is a point where these two traditions do converge in the sense that it's not simply an aesthetic tool for sort of sentimental awareness. An image is meant to be something that draws you into action, and that is itself drawn into your action.
So what then one
do
with a given gift? Lots and lots of icons, and one doesn't have kind of enough room in one icon corner, one can't destroy them.
gives them away. This is, I mean, I get icons everywhere I go to speak. I always get several of them. It's a tradition in Orthodox churches that when someone comes to your parish to speak, you give them an icon as a gift of thanks. And if you speak often enough, you end up with hundreds and hundreds of icons. And actually, for part of my life, I just kept them all, thinking, oh, you know, they were given as a gift with prayer and thanks. And my icon corner expanded to such, I mean, I literally had about 300 icons. Oh, wow. It was more of an icon room. But then again, the number starts to defeat the purpose, because you can't actually use icons functionally if there are that many of them, in terms of an active engagement with the images. That it's simply overload. So I did end up giving a lot of them away. And I think that's a fairly ancient Orthodox practice as well, is to give and receive
music. I'm wondering about the popular usage of icons for healing purposes, like it happens with some of them in the Catholic Church. If you could say something about how the Catholic Church uses also the Orthodox icons, whether there's any significant difference between the way it is used in the Orthodox Church and the Catholic
Church. Well, allow me to read you just a very brief text. That harks on to, I'll come back to the healing icon question in a moment, but it harks to the second, which is, how does something like the Roman Catholic Church use these? I just snipped this out of a journal article, or I guess a magazine article more than a journal. It's the 70 Ecumenical Council in 787 that actually lays down the iconographic canons in response to the iconoclastic controversy. And this is these are the canons that define colours and patterns and the things that I've just described. Let me just read you three short paragraphs. The decisions of the 7th Ecumenical Council were addressed to the whole of the Christian world, but the Frankish King Charles, future Emperor Charles the Great, the Byzantine Emperor's rival in the medieval world, did not accept the Council's decisions, which was the only logical attitude that he might take given the West's confrontation with the East. So we're very much in the thick of East-West rivalry in this time period. So when the 7th Ecumenical Council made this proclamation, Charles flatly ignored it. As a response to the 7th Council's decisions, the Carolingius books were made up in the late 8th century on King Charles' initiative. The books stated that the object of worship is God alone, but by no means icons. Icons can be used only to decorate churches and for the purpose of instruction. For this reason, no canonization of images was to be accepted. Thus, the Western Church did not have iconographic schemes, and this enabled Western European artists to give their own interpretations to Old Testament and Christian subjects. Thus, in religious art, they gradually changed their form from icon painting and created pictures using religious themes and symbols in different manners. The significance of this phenomenon cannot be overestimated. As an artist's work is always a search, and the search bore its fruit, linear perspective, the means to convey motion, and the properties of air and many other things, etc. I think that's probably the fairest statement any Orthodox iconographer has ever produced on Western art. Normally they tend to be a bit more scathing. The point here is that what religious art became in the medieval West was quite different, actually, than what it was in the Byzantine East. And it really wasn't iconography in that sense. It was, as I think this text puts it quite well, the idea of a kind of personal exploration of religious themes that came to be cherished. So it's religious art for, one might say, a very valuable and yet very distinct and different purpose. The rediscovery of the icon in the Roman Catholic Church is a fairly recent phenomenon, actually. Only within about the last 100 years has it become at all widespread, largely through the incorporation of much Eastern iconography back into Roman Catholic schemes. But I would say, and people are certainly free to disagree with me on this, but my experience has been that it's been an absorption of the images without necessarily the understanding of iconographic theology. I think that remains, at least at this point in the dialogue, a thoroughly Eastern thing. but the images themselves are becoming more popular. I mean, even in Anglican churches now, it's almost becoming obligatory in many Anglican churches to have an icon of Christ and an icon of Mary. Westminster Abbey is a great example of this. They're two enormous icons right as you enter. But again, I think it's the image rather than the theology of the icon that's being absorbed. Yeah.
You're talking when the when it's painting, when people paint, and then you figure out the color and that. So I was thinking, who is considered as the agent of painting? Is it God or painter or Holy Spirit?
That's an interesting question, because that I'm glad you asked that. It brings up the whole question of the relationship of divine will and human will, and what does it mean to be inspired, for example. I mean, I could relate this to the question of the inspiration of the scriptures of the Bible. If you believe the Bible to be divinely inspired, do you mean that God wrote the Bible, or do you mean that some people wrote the Bible? Or did God tell some people what to write? I think in the East there's quite a symbiotic understanding of divine will and human will. So you have to be able to say both, really. I mean, an icon is always a human work, but if it's done prayerfully and obediently, it's a divine work. And so God is engaged. So even the act of painting an icon is understood incarnationally. That it's a meeting of the human and the divine. It's a bringing together of these two realities. Which is why when an icon is done, one thanks the iconographer. But the icon is not the iconographer's. The icon at that point belongs to the church. The iconographer... This is why very often, normally icons are not signed at all. The iconographer does not put any indication of their name on it. But sometimes they will on the back, but they'll put the phrase through the hand of so-and-so rather than by so-and-so. This idea that it's they've been involved in painting this icon, but it's not their own. So it's a hard question to answer precisely because it's understood as part of the mystery of the relationship of the divine and the human in the cosmos as a whole. Kent?
The story of St. Luke,
yes.
The Virgin, which also exists in the West. What's the underlying behind that? Is it a story to give an icon of divinity? Is it or a divine origin? There's got to be some reason for that story.
Yeah. I mean, there are a number of ways to approach that, I suppose. Surely the one that you've just suggested may be one of them, that there's a desire to show that icons are intrinsically Christian from the very beginning. They go all the way back to the apostles themselves. On an entirely personal level, I doubt that they do. They seem to be very early, but there's no real indication that that we have apostles sitting around painting icons. I suppose it's not out of the question. That Luke did. The reason that I think gets much more credibility is actually the connection of Luke and Mary. And it's very significant that the icon he's thought to have painted was an icon of Mary. Now the reason that's significant is Luke and Mary actually have quite an intimate history in the church. Luke's gospel, when you read it, is often considered the most motherly of the gospels. The references that it makes to Christ are very maternal and very, very affectionate in the way that some of the other Gospels are not. It's the only account, for example, that gives an extended treatment of the birth of Christ. And the reason for this, according to the tradition of the Church, is that Luke actually went and spent a considerable length of time with Mary and asked her about all this. Tell me about your son. Tell me what it was like. Tell me what it was like to raise him. Tell me what he was like as as a son, as a child. So there is an intimate relationship in that sense between this evangelist and her person. And I think there must be some connection between the tradition of his painting her and this much more widespread and widely accepted belief in the Eastern world that, that Luke knew her and wrote his gospel after interviewing her, basically. But I think probably there are many reasons why that, that tradition goes around. I mean, it should be said that the icon Luke painted is actually believed to exist and is stored in a monastery in Madaphos in Greece. And it is, well, exactly like the little images you saw. It's the Mother of God with her son. So, obviously, those monks take this story very literally, since that's the icon he painted, but...
Has it been carbon dated?
It is not. No, it is not.
Unsigned, presumably.
Yes, unsigned, yes. Wouldn't it have been nice had he etched on the back, I, Luke the Evangelist? I think,
yes. Question. You mentioned when an image becomes iconic.
Yes.
When does an image become an idol? Or how do you stop an icon becoming an idol?
Excellent question. I think, well, let me say first of all, as a general rule, anything can become an idol. Anything.
Without becoming an icon first.
Well, and I think the question of an idol is precisely one of act and usage. I think there are some things which are intrinsically idolatrous, but they are intrinsically idols because they naturally cause one to be idolatrous oneself. I mean, the idea of an icon is that it propels you beyond the icon. It propels you into something greater. I think an idol, from an orthodox understanding, is something that fundamentally ends in itself, that draws you towards itself. This is how the Orthodox Church understands the injunction against idols in the Old Testament. They're commonly understood to be... I mean, it is commonly understood that this injunction meant you not to have any images, but I shared in my first talk the Old Testament is filled with liturgical imagery, angels and seraphims and all sorts of liturgical imagery. But the idea of an idol being something which, rather than causing the human person to be orientated towards God, orientates it towards itself. The golden calf at the foot of Mount Sinai is a great example of this. The people grow tired of following God, say Aaron fabricates this golden calf, and the people start to worship it. So the devotion turns from God towards the object itself. Whereas in an icon, it's understood, if it's approached properly, to be something that through the image leads one precisely beyond the image through an engagement with its material. So the line is very fine, but absolutely essential. And an icon can become an idol very easily, depending on how one uses it. But then again, so can anything. The Eucharist can become an idol. A priest can be an idol. The Bible is very regularly, to my mind, an idol. The idolification of the scriptures is one of the biggest challenges that Christianity has thrust on itself in the last 200 years, making an idol out of its own scripture. I think it all boils down to approach and ascetical practice. And as I say, I think there are some images which probably are intrinsically idolatrous, in the sense that it's very hard to understand how some images might lead you towards God at all, which is again why the canons are so strict. So, for example, one of the things that is a non-canonical icon is the Trinity portrayed as I often call it, the old guy, the young guy, and the bird. Right? So you've got an old bearded man, a young man, and a bird, Father, Son, and Spirit. Now, the canonical icon of the Trinity I showed you last time, the three angels around the table. Why do you think the other one is uncanonical? Any guesses? Old guy, young guy, and the bird. Why would this be understood as leading towards a false understanding of God?
Inequality between the two persons,
maybe, That's not the main reason. That's an added one, yes? Okay, you've cottoned on to it's the anthropomorphic question that's a real problem. The father never became man. You can't paint the father. So to paint the father as an old guy with a beard is explicitly uncanonical. For the very reasons of tending towards idolatry, it's the kind of image that doesn't lead one towards God, that leads one towards a very false, base understanding of what the deity is. The son did become man, which is why we paint him as a man. The spirit did appear in the form of a dove, which is why it's perfectly valid to paint the spirit in the form of a dove. But you cannot paint the father, which is why in the traditional understanding of the icon of the Trinity with the three angels, you're not allowed to say which one is which.
Oh.
It happens sometimes. But the point is, it's the Trinity. You're not allowed to say that one's the father there, and that one's the son, and that one's the spirit.
And is that the only iconic representation of
Yes. Well, yes and no. The other icon, which is sometimes called an icon of the Trinity, is the icon of the baptism of Christ in the Jordan. Because you have the Son standing in the water, the Spirit descending in the form of a dove, and the voice of the Father ascending from heaven. So that event is understood to be the purest revelation of the Trinity. But again, you're not seeing the Father. But you know from the story that his voice is echoing through this painting.
Sorry, could I just
Yeah,
summarize?
Please, yeah, go ahead.
To summarize, would I be correct in saying that an icon is representative of what it... of representative of God or Christ?
Mm.
Would that be too simplistic?
I would prefer it along the lines that an icon engages the person with Christ. Now, yes, it uses representation for that, but it's deeply, as we've looked, symbolic representation. We saw that sometimes that symbolism is a deliberate distortion of reality. The baby Christ with grey hair and a wrinkled brow, for example. Things that are clearly not meant to be taken literally. But the idea that through those kinds of symbolic representations, the person is engaged with the truth of Christ, with the person of Christ and his fullness. But I would say, I mean, going back to your first question, I think the fundamental distinction is that an icon engages beyond itself, whereas an idol sort of stops with itself. That's the Eastern understanding of the difference. It's certainly open to fair criticisms, but that would be the traditional Eastern way of understanding the distinction between an idol and an icon.
Does the Eastern Orthodox Church face criticism from the West as being idol worshippers?
Traditionally, no. It faces massive criticism from the Protestant West.
That'd be pretty expected,
but keep in mind that from the traditional Eastern point of view, Protestants are just another sect of Catholics. So it's one variation of the same thing. You're talking about some sort of big family squabbles here. Yes, obviously from a Protestant milieu, Orthodoxy is oftentimes scathingly criticized for being just a bunch of idol worshippers. From a traditional Roman Catholic point of view, no. Going back to the very early Christian days when these were simply viewed as different ways that artistic imagery could be incorporated into a Christian life. That's the way they do it over there, which is fine, but the way we do it here is this. So while the iconographic theology of the East always remained, from very early on, from the 5th, 6th century, a predominantly Eastern phenomenon, it was never repudiated by the West. It was simply never very important. For example, the whole iconoclastic controversy, which was sort of the biggest event in the history of the Eastern Church, while it was going on, the Pope of Rome in the West sort of said, well, we don't really understand what all the fuss is about. I mean, we quite like our religious art, so yes, of course we support the pro-icon people. But it wasn't a big issue, because it wasn't understood to be a doctrinally confessional issue, which is precisely how the East understood it. when we're talking about images, you're talking about what we think theology is all about, whereas in the West, the Pope would write texts saying, well, when we talk about images, we're talking primarily about the pictures on the walls that sort of put us in the right frame of mind, teach us a little bit. So, of course, we aren't going to side with the people who want us to abolish them, but they don't have the kind of significance to our confessional life that they did in the East. So traditionally there's not been an antagonism there, though antagonisms have a way of flaring up from time to time. Ken, you had a question? Comment?
Well, not sure what my question is, but maybe you can comment something about the connections. You've suggested some things about how the icon is used, quote unquote, ritually before entering the temple proper.
Yes,
certain gestures are made, processions are done. You showed the picture also of in the festival of St. Nicholas.
Yes,
I'm thinking, are there some, let's say, more or less tight ritual connections of the icon with the central rite, which is the Eucharist?
Yes. Yes, there were two that are tied specifically into the Eucharist. And one is the placement of the icon on the doors of the Epanastasis in front of the altar.
Mm.
And the other is the icon in the center of the church. If you think of an Orthodox church in terms of its layout, sorry, I'll just draw this and hold it up. Oh, you've got a whiteboard. Oh, great.
I don't know if we have something to use.
There's some marker. They're good. If you, great.
You just contaminated it.
Good. Standard Orthodox church layout. This is the narthex when you first walk in. There are normally icons on the sides that one venerates on the way in, as we saw being done there. The overall scheme is roughly the shape of a cross. This is the main area of the church. When one enters, there will be a central icon, which is normally the icon of the feast. On a Sunday, that's the icon of the resurrection. There will be an icon of Christ here and an icon of the Mother of God here. So one will walk into the church, will venerate first of all this icon, then this icon, then this icon. Normally nine candles around them. The iconostasis, the wall of icons, is here. This is called the ambon, a little step up on the way in. The royal doors, as they're called, are here. They usually swing inwards. The altar is here. Now, on the royal doors are normally painted the evangelists, the four evangelists, as well as the Annunciation, the angel Gabriel appearing to the Mother of God. So, the two direct linkages of icons into the act of the Eucharist come with these icons here on the doors, and this icon here. These doors are opened and closed throughout the liturgy, as I discussed before, but they're closed right at before the moment when the Eucharist is brought out to the people. And that's very significant, because what one is beholding then, the doors are closed, a curtain is drawn, so all the people who are out here cannot see anything in here. It's completely walled off. What they do see on the doors is that promise of Christ's coming, the angel appearing to Mary with her head inclined. We saw the icons earlier. So they see the promise of God's presence, the promise of his coming into the world, the proclamation of his incarnation. And ultimately, those icons are removed from view when the doors are open, and what one sees instead is the altar on which the incarnate Christ is present in the Eucharist. So the icon gives way to the reality.
Hmm.
before that happens, while the clergy are receiving their communion in the altar, normally the choir will be singing some staging music, i.e. music to kill time, because it takes a while for the clergy to do that. But it's actually, it has become a significant part of the liturgy at that moment, because all of the people will then file up and venerate the central icon. And this harks back directly to the iconoclastic controversy of the 8th century. Before you go up to the chalice, you must confess that you're really Orthodox. You're not a heretic. And how do you do that? By venerating an icon. So this is a very ancient confession of being Christian by venerating an icon right in the middle of the church so everyone could see it. So before you were allowed up to the chalice, you made a confession of your faith simply by going up and venerating the icon. So again, that tradition, which you still see done in churches today, before people go up to commune, they will go up and they will venerate the icon and then they will venerate everyone else. I.e. they'll go up, they'll kiss the icon, and they'll turn around and bow to all the people, asking their forgiveness before they go to receive communion. That leads into another interesting observation, which is, once the doors are opened and the chalice is brought out, no veneration of icons is thereafter permitted. Because in the presence of God himself in the chalice, it's considered inappropriate to venerate the image of Christ who is now present. Similarly, once you have received communion, traditionally you will not venerate an icon for the remainder of that day, because you've received Christ into your body. And for the same reason, you wouldn't ask a priest for a blessing on the same day that you've received communion, nor would you kiss a priest's hand or any of the normal things that you would do, because you have received the greatest blessing into yourself, which is Christ himself. So the Eucharist feeds back into the veneration of icons in that way. So, for example, once you've received the Eucharist, when you walk out of a church, normally when you leave a church, you repeat all the same steps that you committed on entering it. You would venerate all the icons on your way out. But if you've received the Eucharist, you won't. Mm. You don't venerate icons after receiving the Eucharist.
Is that very explicitly known by...
It is, but unfortunately it's not always practiced. And we find a lot of people, it's something we continually have to remind people in the churches, that you're not to venerate. I mean, one of the biggest faux pas that happens, because people just don't know what they forget, is that once the chalice is being brought out and people are coming up to receive communion, people will still go up and venerate this icon in preparation. But the rule is, once the chalice is out, nobody venerates anything.
It's very complicated.
Well, yes, it is. But I think the Orthodox Church is, well, I mean, the whole idea of having canons is very complicated. But the idea is, each of these regulations, I mean, eventually they're just absorbed. You don't think about them. You don't even notice them. They're just, they frame in the way you think. In the same way that when you've been driving long enough, you're no longer going through the highway code in your mind as you drive. It's just part of your consciousness at that part that this is how you do it. But each of those is designed to define that consciousness in a specific way. So the strictures on when you venerate and when you don't are designed to remind you, remember, God himself is more important than the pictures of God, even though they are sacred. So these complicated rules are there to remind you of that relationship.
Can I ask you about mass production of icons?
Yes.
They probably wouldn't be seen all as icons. Or I mean, you know, you go into all the knick-knack shops in Greece and they're just wall-to-wall reproductions of icons.
Well, I mean, they are seen as icons. I mean, an original icon, i.e. a board with paint on it, they tend to be very, very expensive, actually. I mean, an icon this size, which is a fairly large icon for sort of home use, I would say normally the ones that people have at home are roughly about that size, anything down to sort of that. But I mean, something like this would probably be costing close to £300. They take an immense amount of labour to produce an icon. And they take, to paint something like this would probably take about a month and a half. And that's after you've prepared the board and everything else. So And also there's just the belief that a labourer should be paid for their wages. Mm-hmm. So they're very expensive. But when you're talking about decking out a church, for example, which has icons this size, you know, something like this is going to cost several thousand pounds. An iconostasis would cost tens of thousands.
But obviously these mass-produced ones are on sale in shops. I mean, people buy them as sort of knick-knacks.
Oh, yes. I think buying them as knick-knacks is entirely inappropriate. Mm-hmm. But buying them as things to take home and use for prayer is I think most people's icon corners, if you look at them, mine personally, I've got two icons that are originals, painted icons, and all the remainders are reproductions.
What about, I mean, somebody who's not a Greek Orthodox?
Yes.
And using it with reverence?
Yes, yes.
Maybe yeah. Not in the same way yeah. as a Greek Orthodox person. I mean, how would the Greek Orthodox do that?
It has sort of a mixed attitude. On the one hand, it's very good that that happens, if it's done with reverence. Which is why monasteries will sell icons and parishes will sell icons to anyone. You don't have to be Orthodox to buy one. I think here people would draw a little bit of a distinction between a real icon, a painted icon, and a reproduction. I think Orthodox people would get a little nervous, for example, giving a painted icon to someone who is non-Orthodox, simply because they would be worried that it would be treated with respect. If they knew it would be, there would be no problem. But the idea of something like that eventually being thrown out, that would mortify an Orthodox person. So they might be a little hesitant. Not because there's anything wrong with an icon being in the hands of a non-Orthodox person, that's not a problem. But it is the idea of, do you know it's going to be, are you sure that it's going to be treated with respect and devotion? If you are, then fine. I mean, I've given icons away to people who are non-Orthodox all the time. And you just have to say, well,
have not been struck by lightning.
Not yet. Not yet. One waits.
Well, thank you. Thank you indeed very much.
Thank you all.
For a wonderful illumination on this endlessly deep topic.
Thank you. And in a fortnight, we're back.
We're back. One more round.
Matthew, I asked if I wondered, would you think I was terribly sacrilegious to have a light from St. Basil?
Oh, very good.
Given to me by a Greek Orthodox friend.
Oh, let me see.
I don't know if it is actually painted.
Oh, that's very nice.
It is nice.
Good.
Now, how would you know that's St. Basil?
Because it says St. Basil on the front. I use Vasilios. Mm-hmm. But also it looks like him. That's one of the hardest things to say. Until you spend a lot of time with icons, it's hard to know, but that's just what Basil looks like in iconography.
Well, presumably not facial, but what is it? Is it what he's wearing?
It's a combination of his garments and his hair. Basil is normally painted with brown hair, mm-hmm. Whereas most people have grey.
Okay.
But Basil died very young,
okay.
So he's normally painted with brown hair.
Right.
He's relatively skinny. He's never painted very plump. Nor is he balding.
And is there a difference in green garment?
Because he was a